Welcome to the In Common podcast. This is Stefan Partolo. Today I'm speaking with Daniel Aldrich. Daniel is a professor of political science and public policy at Northeastern University in Boston. He received his PhD from Harvard University and has published over 70 peer-reviewed articles and 5 books on topics related to social capital and community resilience in relation to disaster risk reduction, with a focus on public policy. He has been referred to as a social capitalist, given his wide-ranging research and writing showing the value of building social capital with public policy and the essential role social capital plays in avoiding disasters caused by natural hazards. In the podcast, we discuss Daniel's personal experience having to evacuate his family during Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans in 2005, and the role that neighbors and informal networks played in helping his family navigate the loss of their home, and the role that government and markets did not play or could not play. We then discuss what the concept of social capital is, how to measure it effectively with interdisciplinary methods, and how public policy interventions can proactively build social capital in at-risk communities. Please enjoy my conversation with Daniel Aldrich. Let's just hear a little bit about your background, how you got into academic work, and what is kind of your origin story that got you where you are today.
It's my villainous backstory. Right. So I began, I would say, in more mainstream political science, interested in contentious political politics. So, for example, how local groups protest or fight against unwanted projects, mostly energy projects, actually, and mostly in Japan. So that was my first dissertation projects and everything else, which was going fine. Then my first job offer was in New Orleans, Louisiana. So we moved down from Boston in the summer of 2005 in July. Okay. We had about 6 good weeks in New Orleans before Hurricane Katrina arrived. And that really was the backstory that changed everything for me. You know, we had no idea what was coming. We were completely naive, my wife and I. We had 2 small kids at the time. And we actually planned on staying. We had a one-story house. Kids couldn't swim, and we didn't know what was going to come. So we were watching over the weekend as neighbors were packing up. We did not pack up. We watched as neighbors drove away with their dogs and their grandparents and everything else, and we did not. And then finally, Saturday night, really late, after the guests we had over actually departed, a neighbor knocked on the door and said, "What are you guys still doing here?" And this was, I think, the 27th of August, the day before the hurricane really arrived. And we said, "Well, you know, we just got here. We've furnished our home. This is my first academic job. We bought a car. You know, this is everything we have." And they said, just take a few days of clothing, some toys for your kids, get out of here, come back." So we did that morning, Sunday morning now. We left really early. Got stuck in the massive traffic jam that turned a 4-hour drive to Houston into a 14-hour drive to Houston. Got the very last hotel room in a Days Inn on the edge of the city, and spent the night there Sunday night, thinking we'd come back pretty soon. Monday morning, the storm was gone, right? The rain had stopped, but we heard these shouts from the lobby in the hotel we were staying. Everyone else in the hotel also was from New Orleans. And of course, the levees had broken. In fact, we lived in a community called Lakeview, which became Lakeview because as the levee broke, right, trillions of gallons of water flooded in from the lake and also then from the river as well. So those two came together. And of course, 80% of the city was underwater, including our house, our car, my hard drive, pretty much everything that we owned at the time. So I had this really naive notion. This was now right early September, right? So school, Tulane never opened that fall because, of course, it was completely flooded. Scott Cowan was the president. He was doing a heroic job to keep everyone together as much as he could. But, of course, the university wasn't open. People were going elsewhere. So I never began teaching that fall. My kids never began school that fall. And my wife and I were climate nomads at that time. And I had this, you know, interesting idea. Well, look, we have these two pillars of society, right? We have the market. And we have the state. So the market is insurance, right? Or preparedness. You have your kit, you have your investments and your flood insurance, whatever, that'll save us. Or the state, right? FEMA will come through. This big check will arrive at our front door and it'll say, "Here's $1 million, go back and rebuild, get that car, build the house again." And of course, neither actually happened. That was completely wrong. The insurance never activated, so we had no coverage and anything in our home. Not our car was worthless. It was like about 12, 15 years old at that point. And the FEMA thought we had insurance. So FEMA told us that in the fall of 2005, "Sorry, we can't help you." So neither came through. But as we're sitting there kind of in shock, I mean, looking back now, it was definitely shock, actually. We just were sort of stunned. Our little kids thought we were on vacation in Houston, you know, not going to school, not doing anything else. We're sitting around the house and began to wonder, what the hell are we going to do? all of a sudden the phone begins, these texts come in, emails come in, phone begins to ring, and it's people, not direct family, but friends, friends of friends, other organizations, faith-based groups, academic institutions around the country, Colorado, Philadelphia, Boston, Chicago, Washington, D.C., asking us, do you need a place to stay? Do you need a place for kids to go to school? Yes, we do. Both yesterday was, do you need a job this semester? Yes, that'd be helpful. So the way we came back that fall had nothing to do with the market or the state. It had everything to do with our network. And I began to wonder, okay, well, you know, I'm an academic by training. I've never done this disaster stuff before. Maybe if I start reading about this, I'll find tons of articles that support this idea that our experience was normal or somehow plausible at least. And of course, if you start reading stuff back then in the early 2000s, everything was from the economists, right? About market equivalencies and, you know, catastrophic bonds and these really naive concepts, again, based on state and market. There was one article I found by Nakagawa and Shah. And they had argued, this is way back when, I don't know, almost maybe 7-8 years before the disaster for me, that there's this thing called social capital that was really important. It was a qualitative comparison of the Gujarat earthquake and the Kobe earthquake. I read their piece and I was like, holy crap, that's probably it. So I immediately proposed, this is still the fall of 2005, right? So no job, a lot of free time to read. I proposed this grant with the Abe Foundation, which was, I think, it's no longer giving money now, but back then it would give you money to do multiple country comparisons. And I said, look, you know, I'm a privileged white person living in North America. We're supposed to have it all. These networks helped me. How about 100 years ago in Japan? How about a few years ago in the Indian Ocean tsunami in Tamil Nadu on the east coast of India? How about in those societies were far removed from all the good stuff nowadays? What would happen? You know, what was a powerful aspect? I got the grant, ended up going that next year then, spending a year and a half or so in the field. And that became the first book I wrote called Building Resilience. Not Brazilians, which my students often wonder, oh, why would I go to Brazilians, but Building Resilience. And that really was the origin story. From that moment on, I've been obsessed with this idea that what really helps us during shocks and disasters has so little to do with what we typically invest time and money in, right? So again, you know, governments are always promoting the kit, get out there, get your kit ready. Is your cell phone charged? Do you have bottles of water ready to go? Or in some cases, like in Japan's case, they build a $240 billion gray infrastructure project, these seawalls. And they tell everyone, you know, we've got this, right? No need to evacuate. We're going to protect you from tsunami or whatever else comes along. And I think both those extreme approaches, that it's all about you as an individual or the government will save you, both of those are pretty wrong. And I think most of the evidence we've had, and we've done work in now a bunch of different countries over time, different disasters, consistently found that these social capital ideas, the bonding, bridging, and linking ties are the most critical. So anyway, that's how I got into this. Again, didn't begin that way. That wasn't my goal. Giving an academic, but when you go through a shock, I found for me at least, it really changes the way you think about what matters in terms of, you know, what do I want to do with my career? How do I want to publish stuff? Am I just in this to get tenure? And I've kind of been a crazy advocate for social, like some people call it, social capitalist, out there advocating that, you know, too many of our disaster preparedness programs don't really think so much about either the consequences of the disaster on the social network or how social networks are a critical part of the disaster process, both preparedness and recovery, but people don't seem to recognize that in the actual plans they have.
Why do you think there's such a persistent narrative? It seems like that narrative still transits today, that a lot of the disaster risk reduction programs and relief efforts are about either investing in physical infrastructure in advance and these kind of preparedness kits and things like that, or they're about, you know, quick response, so like making sure that it gets there as fast as possible afterwards. One of the reasons seems to be that community, like the idea of social capital, is very informal, in a way intangible. Do you feel like that? What is your impression of what's the reason why it hasn't been uptaken into kind of mainstream policy thinking?
Yeah, this is a great question and one I've struggled with for a long time. I think there's a bunch of reasons why social capital and what I would call social infrastructure, the places and spaces that we build these ties, get short shrift when it comes to thinking about disasters and recovery. First is, there's literally an entire political economy around recovery in the sense of the big firms, right? So again, whether it's the Japanese construction firms that build these huge concrete press things, or in New Orleans, where the vast majority of people I talk to, local contractors, if they got money, it had trickled down, right, from this massive international firms that had won all these big grants to do stuff, to build bridges and roads and ports. Bridges and roads and ports are visible. It's pretty obvious, you know, if you have or haven't built that, you can point to it as a politician and say, look what I did to save you or to help you back. So it's all those things come together. It's the ability for people to point to it and say, this is a political victory for me. Unlike social capital, which is a little more intangible, it's a clear thing that we know what it does. So we know a road is how you get to point A to B. Okay, so a bond to social capital, but a bonding social capital, what does that do for me, either as a politician or a resident? Maybe not so obvious. Not to mention a lot of the building money that comes in, it's informed by past spending ease. So in other words, there's really easy tracks in big bills to get money along these old school ways. There isn't so much money for Build Back Better. There isn't so much money yet for social capital, social infrastructure. So it's easier. Like in Japan, the moment there's a shock, I was just in Japan 2 weeks ago, there's a community in Okayama Prefecture called Mabicho. They had a pretty horrible flood a few years back. 50 people died, which was pretty unusual for modern Japan. And literally within a matter of days, the central government had brushed off this huge $400 million river-changing project to move the river around the area where 50 people had died. Now, if you actually calculate per people resident there, you could have easily given each one of them the money to relocate as a group to a better neighborhood, built mm-hmm. nice houses simply above the floodplain. But rather than doing that, the government had this plan already, which they knew would benefit construction firms, which would then benefit politicians who then reelected, who then benefit. So you have this whole process in the background where oftentimes people don't want to waste a good disaster by actually talking to people what they want, right? They're going to go ahead instead and pour that money into things that they already have on the books. One of my colleagues in Japan, Nagamatsu Shingo, calls this the Fuku Mujun in Japanese, the reconstruction paradox, where oftentimes if you actually track population recovery against spending, the communities where the spending is highest, again, where we're pouring in hundreds of millions of dollars in aid really quickly, not really aid, that's the wrong thing to call this. I would call this hundreds of millions of dollars in spending. So typically gray infrastructure projects, recovery actually is slower than in communities where that money isn't coming in as fast. And he likes to talk about this idea that if you're a local resident, and you're waiting for your normalcy to come back, right? I want my barista back at Starbucks, my kids in school, my job back in my home. Pretty small universe I live in. I don't really care if there's a brand new port or a huge bridge or this massive new seawall that's present. That doesn't necessarily help me, right? The likelihood of a disaster happening again right now is pretty low. And those things slow everything down, right? Construction is messy. It slows down traffic. It slows down people coming in. So as I'm waiting for my life to come back to normalcy, I see the state investing in these huge projects. Not much to do with me. I mean, unless I'm a construction firm. So he calls this the construction paradox, that money pours in, but it's not really what people want. So if you ask the person who lives there, like if you'd asked me in New Orleans, what would I need to get back on my feet quickly? It would have been housing, my network, and a job, right? That would have been very straightforward. And unfortunately, much of the spending went to levies. Of course, again, we have this whole Morganza to the Gulf project, right? Which is even a larger project, which engulfs part of New Orleans and is essentially trying to wall in at some level most of southern Louisiana, right, within levees and berms and dams. So again, these are ongoing projects. A disaster comes along, a flood comes along, politicians justify spending money because look, you know, we have this shock, we have this plan in place already. We don't need to wait and ask people what they want or spend years messing around. You know, one of my favorite examples comes from Japan. After the 2011 triple disaster, some communities really slowed things down in the recovery process. They didn't jump into this massive spending. They didn't immediately go to seawalls. They took their time. It really frustrated a lot of the government officials who, of course, have X number of years to either get reelected or to spend the money, right? So it's messy, right? The process of deliberation of what do we want? Do we want to build a seawall? Do we want to relocate? Do we want to do both? And a few communities, just a handful in Japan, like Onagawa, one of my favorite towns there, decided not to build a seawall. Nothing. There's no seawall. You can see directly from the village all the way out to the ocean. It's one of the very few places left in the entire Tohoku coast where there isn't some 15 meter seawall there blocking the view of the ocean, which of course was why many people moved there to begin with, right? Mm. So I think there's a lot of these factors that really slow down the integration of social capital and social infrastructure into the recovery process and into the planning process.
Well, that kind of leads me to two questions about social capital as a concept that I've been thinking about, but just also from what you've been talking about now is one is how do we measure social capital? So how do we know that it's there or not, or in what forms that it is? And the second question is, if we know it's so beneficial for these communities, how can we build policy interventions that can proactively build more social capital in communities at risk? But maybe we can start with the like, how do we measure and think about social capital? So it's, like you said, it's easy and tangible to look at gray infrastructure or even green or nature-based solution types of infrastructure and maybe a better case. But what, how do we know that communities have social capital or not?
Yeah, this is a great question. And I always think about this with my students as in, you know, gross national happiness or things like health. Right. So we know those are real things. We know that, for example, if everyone in the country is really unhappy or depressed and anxious, right, overall things are not going to work as well. Or if people are, let's say, unhealthy, right, if the overall society doesn't have running water that's healthy. So we know those concepts are vague and ambiguous, just like social capital feels vague, but we know we can capture them. And that's how we start with this optimistic perspective that even though it's not a visible thing, and say that health isn't necessarily visible, we can capture it somehow. So actually a colleague and I, Dean Kine, he and I sat down a few years ago and said, look, this is getting really frustrating. We have so many studies out there using different measures of social capital, right? So you might ask people about trust. To what degree do you trust your neighbors? Or to what degree do you feel that if there's a problem, they'll come help you? This is kind of the same idea. But you also might ask questions about engagement. How often do you go out with neighbors or have neighbors to your home? These are sort of Putnamian questions, right? Robert Putnam, one of my mentors at Harvard, right, thought about this question and right in Bowling Alone. Are you joining organizations like the Bowling League or the 4-H or the Knights of Columbus, whatever we still have these days? So those are all sort of ad hoc measures, right? If we can get in on the ground level and ask people those questions, maybe in a survey, maybe a phone call, maybe knocking on doors. But Dean and I wanted to figure out a way without having to knock on the doors of 400 million Americans, would it be possible to capture this? So we spent a lot of time on this idea, actually. So let's go back to the bonding, bridging, and linking. So bonding social capital, the easiest way to think about this is are people that are like me. So fast talking white guys in their mid-40s, right? That's a pretty easy way to think about this. So bonding social capital means probably a lot of our friends and connections look and sound like us. So if English is my first language, probably most of my friends of English is a first language. If I live, like when I was doing in Tamil Nadu and people there spoke Tamil, so probably in the networks in Tamil, the first language was Tamil, or English was a third language, probably after Hindi. So bonding social capital means people are similar. So we try to figure out how do we capture this in a systematic objective way, looking at things like race, looking at things like gender, looking at things like ethnicity, place born. So we put together an index with about 8 different ways of measuring similarity in the community. And that was our first cut at this idea of measuring bonding social ties. To what degree is the community homogenous and similar? So for example, about 96% of Japanese communities are made up of people who were born in Japan and speak Japanese. Less than 4% of those are people who don't speak Japanese as a first language, but came to Japan from some other country. They came from Malaysia or Philippines or North America, or Russia, whatever. Okay, bridging social ties in contrast often come through institutions. Clubs, schools, after-school activities, YMCAs, churches, mosques, synagogues. So here we're much more interested in that sort of idea of joining a bowling league as opposed to your close friends you grew up with. Mm-hmm. So here we're interested in, for example, union memberships, the interactions and giving to a number of organizations in the area, horizontal memberships. So the questions we have for bridging social ties, try to capture these heterogeneous ties that are often tied to institutions. Bonding and bridging ties are horizontal ties. Vertical ties are called linking ties. So do I know my decision makers in the council, in the governorship, in the state legislature, in the national legislature? So we want to capture there the degree to which the community is engaged with local, regional, and national politics. Are they voting, for example? Do they have people that they know? Are there letters being written? Are there demonstrations or protests? So we try to capture all three of these, bonding, bridging, and linking. I'm not saying we did it perfectly. I think we did an okay job. And that was one model of objectively trying to measure social capital. Now, of course, someone's going to say, hey, we forgot about asking about trust. That's true. This measure, because we can't ask 400 million Americans about trust, doesn't have trust as a direct variable. So if I'm doing a survey of a community and I have time, we have around 15 single-spaced pages of questions that we could ask. You don't ask all of them, but we do have a lot of questions that we've used in the past. So trust is typically one of them. So we might ask people about, again, trusting neighbors, trusting first responders, trusting decision makers. So we found pretty consistently, and by the way, other organizations around the world have done this. World Bank has done this. Facebook actually has their own cohesion index they've put together from Facebook posts. We've actually worked with Facebook in some of our publications to measure evacuation behaviors and bonding, bridging, and linking ties. Nextdoor as well has tried to capture this. So a lot of organizations organizations recognize two important things here. One, it is possible to capture social capital. It is a vague idea. I might ask you, okay, you know, how often do you interact with friends? How often do you leave your screen behind and take a walk with someone else or go to a restaurant with someone, right? I might ask those kind of active questions. But we recognize it's real, even though it's sort of hard to think about sometimes. And the second thing is we are seeing it done. People are actually measuring this. So Facebook's doing this. We've done this as a lab. A lot of scholars out there have done this. Again, memberships and associations, trust and so forth. So I think those give me a lot of hope. We do see people using the index that we created called the Social Capital Index, or SOCI, S-O-C-I, and a lot of other indices out there. For example, Susan Cutter's Vulnerability Index incorporates some aspects of social capital, BRIC, COBRA, there are a lot of other measurements out there that recognize social capital matters. Maybe it isn't top of the list for them, but they recognize it matters and try to capture it. So I'm hopeful that, you know, as time goes on, we'll get better. The other thing we've been using, and this is a new area, is mobility data. This is pretty interesting. So Rav Chetty has been doing a lot of work with this, for example, with his team. Rav is the economist. And what they've been trying to measure is the degree to which, again, people are literally mobile together. So if I leave my house, do I go to a park? And if I'm there, am I near someone else who's not from my family and not from my household? And the kind of creepy thing and the good thing about mobility data is we actually can see if two cell phones are within, you know, 10 meters of each other for a long period of time, they're probably hanging out. They're bowling together. They're talking together, having lunch together. And so Rav Chetty and his team have been using a variety of measures of social capital to try to figure out how does this change our economic mobility? So for example, if there's parks and schools nearby where kids from rich families and kids from poor families are getting together, does that connection, that bridging tie, again, between different types of people, does it actually alter the ability of the poor person to do stuff? The answer coolly is yes, which is a really good sign this stuff's working, as we think it would. So again, so let's say I'm from a poor family, and Stefan, you're from a wealthy family, we go to school together, it's now our junior year, and I say to you, hey, what are you doing? I see you busy all the time. And you say, I'm writing these college applications. And I say, that's not really for me, and we start talking about it. And eventually you convince me, through a school counselor, to write to apply to college. It's a huge thing, big thing in mobility, right? The idea that I could go from a family that didn't have college graduates to being the first. It's a massive step forward in terms of economic mobility, often would come because we'd been friends, I'd seen you working on this and you gave me some, and that's exactly what Rav Chetty, by the way, argues in his set of papers he published recently, these ties of economic consequences. I'm less interested in the economic consequences. I think it's great that we have these, but it's another proof to me that yes, this is what bridging social capital means. Again, different backgrounds, sharing information, making a positive outcome together.
So how much of the work is kind of based on survey quantitative work versus kind of getting more in-depth qualitative understanding about how an individual might actually navigate such a situation?
Yeah, so I tell my students any paper written with only a single method is pretty thin. Every single method you can think about, right? So doing interviews face-to-face, qualitative interviews, a survey online, a GIS mapping process, social network analysis. Any one technique you have has flaws. And of course, data collection has flaws. So I always encourage everyone in my lab to think about multiple ways of collecting data. So for the books I published, I mentioned already this one called Building Resilience. I didn't just study surveys of people in New Orleans. I actually went back. I did a lot of conversations with people who lived there and asked them about questions. Okay, so what happened during the shock itself? How did you get out? Like our story. Did someone encourage you to get out? Did you have help from people on the outside? And then the recovery process, where did the aid come from? Was it from family members? Was it from the government? Was it from private networks? So we can ask those kind of questions. And then I've written two books since then. The most recent one was called Black Wave. That was about the Japan's triple disasters. I spent about 2.5 years in Japan on a variety of Fulbright and other fellowships doing this research. So spending time in the communities where there was a disaster, interviewing survivors and their families, talking to NGOs and decision makers, but also capturing a lot of data. So for example, city level data on how cities did in the terms of the recovery and survival processes, interviewing also decision makers, politicians, to see how these changed their networking strategies that they used over time. And then looking at about 130 countries that had been through major disasters, trying to figure out, is there a way to capture this idea that these kind of networks, these linking connections between citizens and decision makers would impact not just one disaster, but let's say mortality over time. So one of the chapters I have in that book looks over time and says, how does it make a difference if your society, if your government, in fact, spends more money on things like social safety nets, for example, and then you have a series of disasters versus, let's say, you spend less money? And of course, you can intuitive, yes, the answer is yes, controlling for a lot of other factors. When governments listen to their people and spend money on them, let's say you have a North Korea question, you can do guns or butter, literally. You can get food for the people or buy more nuclear weapons. Buy nuclear weapons means if there's another famine, another COVID event, a flood, there's simply less there's less mobility for people in terms of getting out of that shock than in a society, let's say, like Japan, like North America, where we do our best, not a great job, but we do our best to spend some money at least on the social welfare nets to keep people safe before and after shocks. So I try to use both qualitative and quantitative. Right now, I'm working on a book on social infrastructure, these spaces and places. So a bunch of different things that I've done, spending a lot of time in cafes, which is great, but also libraries, parks, bowling alleys, and karaoke bars in Japan, just sort of observing people. I've got actually students working with me on this as well, spending time in Boston and different places, but also capturing a lot of data. What difference does it make if you're in a community with more higher quality of these kind of facilities, parks, pubs, and libraries, when a disaster comes? And then how about the recovery process? So yeah, I'm really feel fortunate that I don't just get stuck in a single method. I'm definitely more eclectic in my approach. And I think that makes the story more convincing. When someone asks a question, it says, okay, well, you have this 140 country data set, but how about this, right? Then you actually can talk about someone's experience and show, well, it's true at the global level, that variable didn't show up very well, but here's probably why. And you have that story.
So let's say that I'm convinced about the social capital approach. And you mentioned it in your example of the high school students, you know, maybe like two different socioeconomic class students meet. How do I think about designing then the interventions to, we want to make social capital. We realize that some communities have less social capital and they're also maybe prone to certain types of risks that we would like to avoid, for example, in the face of climate change on the coast, et cetera. How would I think about designing that? I find it interesting, for example, nature-based solutions. You mentioned parks and schools,
yep,
things which bring people together. Is there good data on that in public policy about types of interventions that have really worked?
Yeah, this is fantastic. This is the fun part, right? So it's not just the doom and gloom of we have climate change as a problem. We also see some really creative solutions. And by the way, my first answer would be almost all the things that I've seen that have worked have been bottom up, hyper or micro local solutions. So it's funny, you mentioned nature-based solutions. I was just in Louisiana before Japan with a great place called Restore or Retreat. Mm-hmm. And they're based in Southern Louisiana and their whole focus, this is Polly's work, is on restoring marshlands, which are being swamped typically by hurricanes and also kind of ignored by policymakers. And the cool thing about designing them, and I wrecked a really good suit, by the way, getting in the water to go clump around in the thing. First of all, by restoring habitat, of course, we're restoring ecosystems. So the brown pelican, which had more or less gone extinct in Louisiana, even though it's Louisiana state bird, was actually brought back through the recreation of marshlands, especially in Terrebonne Parish and other places that Polly and her crew are working. So we see it works for the ecosystem, but more importantly, you see two things happening with these social infrastructure. One is a lot of volunteers come out. Very, very different backgrounds, the people that I met at least. Very, you know, some of them are state employees, some of them are local fisher people, some of them are just tourists who want to do something good. And together they're working to, again, literally reforest and then replant a lot of these areas, right? So to keep them able to withstand and hold back the energy from waves. So we see less, for example, overtopping of local things, but also these become then recreational facilities. If you have an ecosystem that's restored, you have more fish. So fishermen come out and they fish from these areas. You see people coming out just to tromp around and spend time out here bird watching. So it's a pretty nifty thing, right? And I'll get back to your question in which one second, but I think one of the reasons I really like these interventions that we're about to talk about is almost all of them have not just one benefit, think about a seawall, right? You build a seawall, it's great against a tsunami, but not so great against an earthquake. Right? It's really good against a tsunami, but not so good against a zombie attack, right? Because it's trapping people inside. So, you know, most of the solutions that we have that are gray infrastructure sort of do one thing well, if they're good. By the way, I didn't mention most of the infrastructure in Japan actually collapsed during the 3/11 tsunami. Most of that did not survive. And that, of course, made it worse for people who thought they would have a protection system in place. They didn't evacuate. So that's a whole moral hazard we can talk about. But things like a nature-based solution, like a library, it isn't that you just build the library and you have now a cooling center in hot days and a warming center in a cold winter. But you also have, for example, a place to build skill sets, like English as a second language skills for new migrants to Boston. You had, for many kids who have tough home lives, a place that's safe, they can come after school and feel they can get their work done there. You have free Wi-Fi for people who can afford faster broadband in their homes. You have, on top of all those things, you have some now libraries, this is Noah Lenstra's work, some libraries offer mental health care, some have tool lending libraries, some even have full physical checkups, they have a doctor now, there's like a nurse in some rural lovers that actually brought vaccinations into libraries. These are some of the few places left, these social infrastructure spots, some of the few places left in society that aren't completely taken over by political arguments. Most people that I've talked to, whether you're more conservative or more progressive, most people I've talked to still see a lot of these sites as places where they can bring their kids and their kids can interact. So to go back to your question, how do we build social capital? The first one is like Mr. Rogers' advice, Mr. Fred Rogers, when I was a kid. Of course, he argued we should be good neighbors. So Australia has Neighbor Day. Australia is a continent with a lot of challenges. As you probably know already, you know, the vast majority of population is on the coastal areas. The core of the inland, the outback is relatively uninhabited. And those areas on the edge, of course, have coastal flooding. They have fires. All kinds of stuff's going on, not to mention all kinds of things that can kill you. I spent my sabbatical in Australia. So a lot of things can kill you there. Spiders, blue ringed octopi, all kinds of snakes. I mean, amazing variety of things, plus all the animals made of leftover parts like echidnas and marsupial things that seem to be put together from different pieces. But so what Australia did was they have a neighbor day, meaning that one day they encourage everyone in the community to knock on the door of a neighbor and say, hi, I'm Daniel. You know, what's your name? We've never met, especially in a high-rise building, right? In the urban areas, I've never met. What's your name? Why? Because we know that during a shock like a heart attack or a fire or a flood, the people who show up first aren't uniformed first responders. They're the zero responders, the people there all the time. So we actually, this happened, both the things I mentioned happened. We had a fire behind my house and we had a medical emergency right nearby. And in both of those cases, well before the fire or police arrived here, it was neighbors getting neighbors out of homes. It was neighbors helping other neighbors out through windows. All that stuff was happening well before the fire trucks and the police showed up. So the first thing we want to do to build ties, we know this works, is neighbor fest, this kind of this of people getting together. The second thing up from individual neighbors is building a community. In fact, San Francisco's city government think this is so important. This is Dan Holmes's work, that they will give you several thousand dollars every year to hold a party. And not a party just for you and your family. It's a neighborhood block party. Why do they do this? San Francisco knows they have a massive seismic shock coming down the Rhine sometime soon. There's going to be a big earthquake there. And a lot of that city is built on landfill, meaning there's going to be some pretty serious casualties. So the city can't retrofit every building. It's too expensive. The seismic dampening is just too much money to spend on older buildings. And they also can't get to every place in time, right? There won't be enough ambulances and hospital beds for people who are, but they can build social ties at a fraction of the cost, that every block has a steward or a captain, someone who's knowing, okay, this person has diabetes, this person has a dog, this person's in a wheelchair, this person has a generator. They have that knowledge. And when there's that shock, people in the community work together. So having that party is the first stage to cooperation. I'll bring the chips, you bring the guacamole, you get the sound permits, you know, you get the bounce house. And it's great to watch the community. Again, nothing to do with disasters. That's why I like these first two approaches a lot. We're not talking about this in terms of a bad thing, like, oh, you should get ready for bad things. No, we want to have a party. We want to see who can get organized, who's going to bring the chips, right? And that's a really positive way to frame this of organizational capability. So neighbors, neighborhood. The next thing is we've been talking about indirectly, at least social infrastructure. And we're doing a lot of research right now showing libraries, parks, pubs, all these kind of areas are often not equally distributed in any city that we've studied so far. We've studied about 27 cities in North America, a number of cities in Japan. It's not that every neighborhood has a library or every neighborhood has a pub or a park. Not that every neighborhood has access to green space or green canopy. It's not true. I mean, I'm sure everyone knows this already. In the same way that our society has tremendous inequalities in other areas, racial inequality in health, racial inequality in education, poor rural urban inequalities and all that as well. We also have, even within cities, different neighborhoods. So part of what my job is to encourage decision makers to think about not building a library in every community, because a lot of communities, they have them. It's thinking about who doesn't have a strong set of these social infrastructure facilities, who's lacking park space or green space, and who's lacking a library, who's lacking a community center. I live in Brighton in Boston. My community is in the bottom third of the distribution of these facilities, meaning my kids on average had 2 to 3 times fewer access to libraries, parks, and the green space than kids in the best communities, the best being the ones with the most. So social infrastructure is another way to build these social ties. I'm on a roll now. That would be faith-based organizations, another form of social infrastructure. So here in North America, and to some degree in Japan, churches, mosques, temples, shrines, synagogues, those still play a role for some people's lives. And those are really important things to include, at least in the recognition that there are spaces that still have these. And finally, we have a fun thing called community currency. Community currency is when you want to encourage people to volunteer. Everyone says they're busy. You know, I don't have time. I've got a job. I've got kids. So what we do typically is spend the time there with a new way of encouraging volunteerism. So the community currency might be Boston dollars or Toronto dollars. It's Onagawa yen. And for every hour I volunteer, for example, that hour of volunteering then gets given back to me. In some cases, it's very formal, like a debit card that could literally have points that I earn. In other cases, it's just like a piece of paper that says Daniel is owed like one free orange at the local market or whatever, one free haircut. In other cases, it's pretty informal. So we bank hours, like Littleton, New Zealand banks their hours. I volunteer for an hour helping you with your grant. I get an hour back helping you paint my fence. We've found everything I just mentioned, the community currency programs, social infrastructure, the neighbor building stuff, and the Neighbor Fest in San Francisco, all of them measurably build social ties and communities. So pretty confident that if you're looking for a way to activate and build bonding, bridging, and social ties, that's pretty important.
So I find the idea that social capital is more of a generic solution that can address a multitude of different problems, like you said about the seawalls. So I'm interested though in the different types of disasters and like how social capital might play out in that. So you gave the example that an earthquake might be different than a storm, kind of a coastal storm that's coming in. And in the sense of the Japan example, the earthquake took out the infrastructure that was supposed to protect against the storm. But there's also different types of disasters, like you said, at the individual level, health issues at the individual level. And then there's things like COVID, which really kind of fractioned the idea of social capital. So what do you see that there's a big difference in how social capital manifests or plays out across these diverse disaster types?
This is a great question. Yeah. So two things. You know, one is I'm often asked, my research is often based in Japan. So, you know, Daniel, how much can we actually learn from Japan? The funny thing is, even within the same city in Japan, so whatever Japanese culture means, in the same city of, let's say, Tokyo or Sendai, Osaka, neighborhood to neighborhood, levels of volunteerism are different, levels of blood drives are different, levels of engagement are different, levels of trust. So we see even in a community that's supposedly more communitarian, there are really big differences and variations in how people engage. My argument has been consistent that these social ties play the same role during a slow onset disaster, let's say like stressors like COVID, or a rapid one like a tornado or a shock. And we actually have pretty good data from both types of disasters. So one of my students, Zeynep Bakliogu, for example, right now in Europe, her thesis was on how these kind of ties help migrants from Syria as they move into places like Turkey, right? So for example, how do you choose where to go, right? There's a lot of countries you could go to. You could go to Germany, you could go to Turkey, you could try going east, right? So where are you going to go? And of course, social ties play a huge role in that during this process. We've done work as well in Uganda, part of the civil war that was there going on there, the guerrilla warfare. So studying how IDPs use these networks as well in that post-moving shock. So they've moved away from the area of a shock, of a conflict zone to an area like an IDP camp. What happens them there? Often these social ties also matter. We've also done disasters like COVID. We had several papers we published on North America and in Japan. So I'm pretty optimistic that even though the forms they take are quite different. So of course, by the way, in Japan, they have these things called chonaikai, which is literally something like inner neighborhood community group, something like that. I just call it like a homeowners association, almost like a thing. It's quite different than where I live. I'm a member of a condo. We have a condos group, quite different form, but the way that same tie works, that bridging tie among homeowners works, is quite similar. And that, again, in both societies, people in the same neighborhood often have different perspectives, different backgrounds, different ethnicities. Even though the form the tie takes is different, it's still the same type of tie, which is to say a bridging tie. And the same thing with family ties, right? Whether I'm in Russia or whether I'm in Uganda, whether I'm in Japan, bonding social capital works the same way during and after that shock. So yeah, for us, I mean, it's almost shock agnostic. We want to make sure we have good measures of the consequences of the shock, but also good measures of these different types of bonds as well.
What is the role? You mentioned that you had this something with Facebook and the other technology apps. I see kind of it's a two-sided thing. There's been critiques that technology and social media can build communities and expand communities and open up communities to new faces. On the other side, there's the argument that they erode communities from place.
Right.
Do you have any research studies or a perspective on that based on the data that you have out there?
Yeah, I mean, several things. First, we have to acknowledge that, especially for younger people, certain types of social media can be devastating to all kinds of stuff, to mental health, for example. We know, especially for adolescents, you know, images, whether it's Instagram or Facebook, that are often of almost perfect looking people, can actually activate depression and anxiety in them. And that's pretty hard to argue. I mean, again, I use Facebook myself. So I'm someone who does use these platforms, but I think we have to start by recognizing there are absolutely mental consequences or mental health consequences for younger people. Older people, you know, I think it's a little bit different. You know, for my parents, for example, are on Facebook now, and it has opened up the ability to stay in contact with family members who they literally may not see again in person. They're in their 80s. They don't travel as much as they used to domestically. So when they have cousins and friends in Ohio, cousins and friends and family in California, for them, Facebook is a chance to connect. You know, maybe the mental health stuff is more suppressed in that kind of case. So I have to think about the demographics for the consequences. At the same time, we have shown pretty well, I think, in a paper that we wrote with Facebook and with Nextdoor, these platforms can be data for good, as they call themselves. There are things they can do quite well. We showed on Facebook as well, I think we had 1 million users we were able to access, that bonding, bridging, and linking ties do work the same way in Facebook that they might work in quote IRL, in real life. Meaning, we studied, for example, during the hurricanes in Miami and in Louisiana, did people evacuate when official warnings came out, or did they stay put in danger zones and vulnerable communities? And of course, every disaster manager wants people to get it the hell out the moment they say, there's a hurricane coming, please leave, right? It's much safer for everybody. There's less rescue, et cetera, fewer deaths. But we know that people don't evacuate. So we were able to categorize people's online presence into bonding, bridging, and linking ties. So again, do you share a same last name? Probably a bonding tie. You know, are you connected through a club? Probably a bridging tie. Do you have connections to the NOAA website or to local meteorological websites? So that's probably a linking tie, right? So we're able to do that pretty effectively. And then look, how do these different ties change your evacuation behavior? And the pretty cool thing was, if the only information that you got came primarily from bonding ties, again, from family, you didn't evacuate as quickly, you didn't go as far. If the information that you got came from a more diverse network, more bridging and linking ties, people telling you, no, Daniel, this is really, it didn't happen for us, but this is really dangerous, you need to get the hell out of there, right? In those cases, those bridging and diverse ties help people evacuate, stay away longer. And that's been pretty consistent across other studies as well. So that's very helpful to have. Nextdoor, as you might know, is sort of a geographically contained Facebook platform. We have really good data that Courtney Page Tan worked on, where she showed that in communities that were active on Nextdoor, asking questions about things like, you know, are you okay? Do you need help? I can offer to volunteer for watching babysitter for an hour, whatever it was. Those more active communities were also communities that got more rebuilding permits, meaning they're moving faster in the recovery process across Texas. So again, even though oftentimes we sort of divide our minds, well, you know, either you're active online or you're active in real life, her research really suggests, in fact, that an activist, someone who's socially engaged, is engaged both online and in real life. So online, I'm asking for people for donations. You know, we have a friend who got hurt, help us raise money. We're doing a fundraising drive, but also in real life, I'm knocking on doors, you know, collecting clothing, whatever. So as opposed to being someone who's just shut in using the computer or someone who's never seen a computer. So I think oftentimes I used to think about this in these dichotomous terms, but her research is really convinced me, in fact, these can be powerful tools, again, not necessarily for adolescents, but powerful tools for adults to use, especially in organizing. There's another paper we worked on about rescues during Hurricane Harvey. And you probably saw about this already, the Cajun Navy, which were literally hundreds of people with boats who just happened to have a phone. So you have a pierogi or a canoe or a kayak, and they're literally getting people off of roofs as the water is rising. So again, this is completely spontaneous. It's a bottom-up process. It's hyper-local. There's no official Cajun Navy. There's no sign-in procedures. There's no ensigns and yeomen, right? This is completely people in their own free time of their own free will who want to help, getting organized by Facebook and WhatsApp. So again, these kind of moments when these apps do have a powerful positive thing to have. I will tell you, though, there's also been negative things, which I saw. I mentioned being involved in the 3/11 disasters. Malicious hackers deliberately put up names of individuals that they knew were alive as being deceased, and flipped it as well, people who were deceased as being alive, just to be cruel. And that's just the reality of humanity, unfortunately, right? Don't read the comment section nowadays. A lot of people just, that's how they have a good time. They're cruel to other people. So we know it can be used for the bad. And I think, you know, it's on tech firms to do a lot more to make sure that these kind of apps, which are so powerful, right? What 4 billion people on Facebook, some ridiculous number like that, right? So much of humanity is engaging in network analysis, network building, friendship creation, knowledge acquisition through these networks. We really should know a lot more and be thinking about how do we stop you know, whatever it is, you know, calls for ethnic cleansing or name calling or ethnic slurs or misogyny, all the things we do know exist online. But at the same time, these are very powerful networks. I mean, we cannot dismiss their importance. And I would say if there's someone listening right now looking for a thesis, this interaction between, let's call it in real life activism and outcomes and online work is really an important one that we don't know enough about.
I have a broader question about perhaps the field of political science. Like you said before, there's this idea of markets and states, and then you kind of discovered social capital doesn't fit in that. It's very much informal and about community level. I think that has a lot to say about the shift from studying government to studying governance and the types of theories that we're thinking about governing in general and what is an effective way to think about governance theory. For example, you know, theories more like polycentricity, where it's more, you mentioned social capital is hyper-local and it's always place, and there's a lot of bottom-up types of decision-making and the top-down type of decision-making times to hinder things. How does that fit in this kind of broader way that we think about governance and political science?
Yeah, it's funny. My students have to read Eleanor Ostrom. And, you know, Dr. Ostrom's work, Nobel Prize-winning Indiana-based political scientist, was brilliant in that she recognized so much of our literature on political science ignored the capacity for self-governance of the commons. And her case studies from Switzerland, from Japan, from Africa, from around the world, really showed that it's not some theory, right, that people are capable of, you know, working together cooperatively, not fighting over resources, not depleting a common pool resource. So I think, you know, one of the places we have to start is the recognition that a lot of the theory we have is, you know, Charles Tilly is fantastic, a lot of the work by Theda Skocpol, Paul Pearson, really state level stuff. But at the same time, you know, where do these meso level phenomena like networks, whether they're formal or informal? And it's so funny, you said social capital is informal. That's true. But of course, we also can organize in the form of a 4-H club or a after school club, right, or YMCA. Those are other ways that you can formally build these kind of connections. But I think, you know, I know myself have not necessarily been in the mainstream of political science. I certainly read what I can from the mainstream political science journals, and I'm a member and I go to conferences when I can. But I would say for a lot of us who do work in issues of resilience, issues of social capital, sometimes political science feels like it's sort of left us behind. And it's and even getting an article into these journals, you know, I've published around 95 peer-reviewed articles, about five books. I have relatively few in mainstream political science journals. And I'm not sure that's because I sort of given up hope that they'll take what I do seriously or that they see disasters and resilience in non-voting ways. Now, if I'm writing about voting and political science, probably likely to get in, if it's a good paper. I think if you're writing about social networks and the ability to, say, to speed up recovery time after a shock, that's not really seen as politics, even though, of course, ironically, that is the very definition. Political science is how power allocates resources post-disaster, you know, who gets what is exactly a political question, right? It's exactly the question. And in my mind, driven by these meso-level phenomenon like social capital, social networks. But I think political science could use more Eleanor Ostroms in our reading lists, more recognition of the role of both informal and formal networks in the process, and maybe a little less concerned about the institutions, right, that are so, you know, Congress, for example, obviously the presidency, right, these are critical stuff. A lot of the published work, certainly from Americanists, has focused on these official institutions, a little bit less, I think, about these idea that these networks themselves have tremendous power.
I have a question about the term social capital itself. I mean, you have social and you have capital. And I think one critique of that is that the term capital is a little bit instrumental. Like, it can instrumentalize a very rich set of social relationships that, you know, from certain other perspectives, like values and narratives and discourses, cohesion. There's a lot of other terms that you could use that try to describe the feelings and emotions that are in social relationships. Do you spend much time thinking about that at all? Or do you think that's...
This question and also the question of social infrastructure. Also, you know, infrastructure is a pretty cold word, typically describing, you know, telecommunications, infrastructure, whatever. How do you talk about social? How can it be social? I think it's a great question. And also there's a big pushback against both social capital and resilience, right? In terms of the neoliberal critique, right? Or the critique of neoliberalism, which is that, you know, somehow these terms, in a sense, seem to give states leeway to back away from responsibilities for caregiving. You know, I've got a bunch of thoughts on that. You know, one is certainly social capital as a term, I think, is here to stay. You know, once you get certain buzzwords, what are called the jargon, embedded in the broader literature, it's kind of hard to move them, even if there are better terms. You could call them communal resources. That's a sort of a value neutral term, communal resources. That's also accurate. So I do that sometimes when I want to be a little more interesting in the writing. But I think for me, it can be instrumental. And I think this is an important thing to recognize. You know, I've got plenty of students who go to literally networking meetings at my university to make connections with alumni, to make connections with business owners, to make with employers. So again, there's no value, there's no judgment there. It's a value-free term. And they are trying to build up a capital. They are trying to build networks. But of course, for most of us, I think it's an unconscious thing. You know, this is the whole loneliness epidemic that we're talking about now. If you read the most recent report from the Surgeon General, the degree to which many Americans recognize they don't have these networks and don't actively build them. So in that case, it should be instrumental. Like we want someone in their 60s who's maybe retired and maybe they're widowed, who doesn't really feel like they're connected, to actively go out there and build these ties for their mental health, for their physical health, for all that kind of good stuff. So I'm not too worried in a sense that the term is going to turn people off or damage the relationship. Resilience as well as a term is a term that I've heard people critique. The simple reality is we're trying to move away from the argument that it's recovery, right? That somehow after a disaster, everything comes back as it was, which I can tell you from experience is not how it works, either mentally or physically or infrastructurally, but that's not what happens after shocks. So resilience is the recognition that there's a certain power in individuals and communities that disasters do, of course, occur all the time. Whether they're, as we call them, natural hazards or man-made. But in most communities, you have the seeds for that recovery into something new, right? And I think that's an important part that does give more power, this bottom-up recognition that between social capital, social networks, and resilience, you are seeing communities that have gone through a number of shocks. I mentioned Terrebonne Parish in Louisiana, number of hurricanes there, the BP oil spill, a lot of stuff's going on, but you still see incredibly active networks trying to build these nature-based solutions, recognizing the poly benefits, the multi-levels of good that come from these new marshlands they're creating. So in my mind, yes, we should talk about this, we should be self-reflexive, but at the same time, we need to do the research. As I've said, there's a lot of stuff going on, climate change, disaster risk reduction, we have a lot of work to do. So I'm less of the navel-gazing worrying about, is social capital the right term, and more, are we getting it right? Are we capturing it correctly? Am I getting the stories of people that I'm talking to accurately as I try to write about what happened to them?
Do you feel like the term is kind of a boundary concept for interdisciplinary work, for example, with community psychology or with sociology, you know, other fields which look at community behavior? Do you feel like that's a term that everyone can agree on or at least focus their intention on?
When you mentioned that, actually, I was just invited to do a talk with a psychiatrist. So obviously, I know nothing about individual psychiatry or therapy, besides what I've gone through myself, right? So no expertise here. But they asked me, you know, would I be willing to talk to someone who does use this term, but of course at the individual level, right? That is to say, it's talking about individual connections. My thought always is much more as a communal resource. So I think it's a great way to get us engaged. In fact, I've done some work with psychologists here in Boston with adolescents, actually speaking of adolescents and Facebook use. We had a lot in common, even though we have very different ways of approaching it, this recognition of the power of networks and social capital. So I do think it can be very helpful, again, in going from sociology, communal work, even community development, right? And I'm thinking just now about, you know, forgetting about, I guess I said, disasters as a bad thing to motivate people, just the idea that we want communities to be actively and engaged, civically engaged, in making decisions, getting involved in zoning meetings, voting. That also, I think, you see the word social capital a lot, which I think is great. And I think it's another way to motivate people and say, look, you know, we may not necessarily have the same political goals, but all of us want a community that makes decisions. So let's see what we can do about getting these people more actively trusting their decision makers and involved in that process.
I have a question about your kind of personal experience in doing this work, particularly, for example, when you're talking with, I don't want to call them survivors, but people who are impacted by these types of events afterwards. The one big project I did on this was in talking with people who survived a large earthquake experience. It was a very emotional experience to talk with these people, and interviewing them was, in a way, I wasn't in a way prepared for it as I should have been and thought about that in advance. But for them, it was very emotional. And I think for some of the people, it was actually the first time that they were telling someone else about what happened to them in a very detailed way. Yep. So what has your experience been with doing that type of work?
Yeah, I mean, first I will say, I regularly tear up oftentimes in interviews with people as my own experiences come back to me. And I tell them ahead of time, you know, if I'm looking sad and to take a moment, it's not you, it's me. So I try to make that very clear to people that I'm talking to that, you know, I myself have these moments when I go back to that, you know, evacuation with my kids and the feeling of panic that we had and the sort of feeling of loss. And at the same time, it's for me, incredibly positive moment to be able to be sitting completely sympathetic with someone else. And whether they're from Japan or Israel or Mexico or North America, wherever the disaster was that we're talking to them about, to be able to share that as a human. And I think for me that, again, it does several things for me. It reinforces my desire to be in the field, to get up every morning and do this work. That's really helpful, even though it is a little painful, and it does reactivate a little bit of the trauma that we had as a family back in 2005. And I think, you know, definitely there's a lot of talk now about sort of ethical disaster research. You know, we did some work on the Colorado, the Marshall fires in Colorado, which you probably remember just now about 2 years ago, I guess, a little bit longer. We're doing a third wave of studies now with some colleagues, University of Colorado Boulder. And we wanted from the very beginning to make sure that we were not, in a sense, making it worse for them, right? So not just the IRB, which oftentimes is kind of pro forma, right? But we really want to think about, you know, how do we get involved with these communities in the long term? And you have to pardon my French, but sometimes social scientists can be kind of seagulls. They come in, they take something and they poop and they go away, not leaving much positive stuff behind. And I think really thinking hard ahead of time, okay, if I'm going to go into Japan, to Mexico, to Israel, to North America, wherever I am, and do this research, even if I'm trying to do it according to the IRB and doing it in an ethical way, what am I giving back? And I think for me that takes a little bit more thought. Okay, so if I'm doing surveys of people, will I show them the answers that they had and their colleagues had? But will I give the data to them first? Mm-hmm. And will I ask permission for them before I start publishing this stuff, going out to a conference and talking about their experiences? Can I bring them with me? And that's been pretty cool. Actually, we've had some very cool panels where we've done extended interviews with people and said to them, would you feel comfortable coming to an event, right? And speaking to a larger audience than just me and my team about what you've gone through. That's incredibly helpful, I think. Actually, I just really side story. I was in Australia doing this with an NGO. One of the people that we interviewed actually joined the team, which was fantastic. And then rather than me telling her story for her, she could tell her story directly. And I think, again, that's just always more, it has more impact when it happens. So that's the second thing. So getting people actually involved in that. And also thinking about, do we actually have a formal process, not the IRB, but actually a community board? Mm-hmm. Are there members of that community that we're trying to interact with, not just once, not twice, not just for, without, you know, again, drop in, take something, poop and leave, but actually stay there and then help out? Like, what can we do? And oftentimes, you know, it might either be a sympathetic ear, but also could be planning. You know, here's what we've seen in other communities. Here's some advice we might have. So I think, you know, the more that we can do, not just to be the person who comes in and takes as a social scientist, but really not only takes the interview seriously and sympathetically, but also can give back. I think that's an incredibly good way to do social science. That's really creating a better world.
Before we wrap up here, where do you think the kind of frontiers are, the questions that you're interested in disaster, in the disaster space or with social capital that you're interested in focusing your time on going forward?
Yeah, I know that there's a lot of cool stuff going on with new types of data. I mentioned mobility data. I think there's going to be a lot of breakthroughs pretty soon. Again, we can always ask you questions about, you know, where were you when the hurricane happened? How long did you stay there? The kind of cool thing now is kind of, again, creepy at the same time, is with anonymized mobility data, we know a lot more about, for example, do people actually leave when they're supposed to? We mentioned this before. Did they get out a few hours after the storm starts? Did they try to get out on foot rather than on car? So we actually have some pretty good insights into that. Rather than asking people questions, we actually can use that mobility data now and get really good stories. So that's one whole area I think it's really interesting. I think the other area now is also, let's call them non-routine disaster risk reduction approaches. So thinking about social infrastructure, what can we do in communities? Not just to harden infrastructure, to fortify the coast, but to think about really getting the community involved itself as a resource in responding. And that's a very different perspective than our job is to go build that concrete wall or build whatever, you know, elevate buildings nearby, move people back. To what degree is the community itself actually involved in decision-making about this? We've seen this a little bit in New Jersey with coastal buybacks, when you have the community discussing for a long time, actually, after Hurricane... I just forgot what hurricane it was in New Jersey. It'll come back to me later, probably tomorrow. But after the recent hurricane there, they actually had a long discussion. What do we want to do as a community? Do we want to move as a community? Do we want to let individuals buy out or buy back? I mean, I think that's the real frontier, right? When we have disaster risk reduction, not as an international Sendai framework, whatever we're talking about, but really the community itself making those decisions. We know we're at risk. We recognize that we have a consciousness of risk. Maybe we don't know what to do about that. What can we then engage experts, academics, local government, regional, national government for aid in thinking about how we want to respond? Not being told we're building a seawall for you or we're moving you, which unfortunately are pretty common in many societies. Boston's talking about a seawall, which is nuts. Boston, progressive city, a lot of academics, many of us study this kind of stuff. I think it's a very bad idea. Those static, again, single hazard infrastructures are not my idea of a good approach. But again, that's a $2 billion project that's being proposed. So we want to think through, how do we get involved? How do we get the communities involved who are actually at the frontiers of these moments of climate change and disaster risk?
Well, thanks, Daniel. It's been super fascinating. It's really, really interesting. I'll have to listen back here to catch all the insights in there. So thanks so much for coming on and the time today.
Thanks for having me.
If you enjoyed today's episode, the best way to support the podcast is to share the episodes you like with friends, colleagues, and students. The In Common podcast is the official podcast of the International Association for the Study of the Commons, or IASC. For more information, please visit our website, www.incommonpodcast.org.